From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Israeli troops shoot dead two Palestinian youths in a village staging daily protests against Israel's wall through the West Bank. We'll go to Na'alan to get the latest. Then, New York City lawyers are trying to force the group Eyewitness Video to turn over hundreds of videotapes of the 2004 Republican Convention. We'll speak to the group's founder. And finally, what are fusion centers and what role is the military planning to take in intelligence gathering during the upcoming Democratic Convention in Denver? All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Anjali Kamath with Sharif Abdul Quddus. Los Angeles Times reports a top government scientist has died in Maryland from an apparent suicide just as the Justice Department was about to file criminal charges against him for the 2001 anthrax attacks. The attacks killed five people and crippled the National Mail Service. According to the report, the scientist Bruce Ivins had recently been informed of his prosecution in the anthrax case. Ivins had worked for the past 18 years at the government's elite biodefense research labs at Fort Detrick, Maryland. Ivins had never been previously identified as a suspect. He was actually part of a team that helped the government investigate the anthrax attacks after September 11th. Investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has revealed the Bush administration recently held a meeting in Vice President Cheney's office to discuss ways to provoke a war with Iran. Hersh said it was considered during the meeting to stage an incident where it would appear that Iranian boats had attacked U.S. forces in the Straits of Hormuz.
There was a dozen ideas proffered how to trigger a war. The one that interested me the most was, why don't we in our shipyard, build four or five Iranian boats that look like Iranian PT boats, put Navy SEALs on them with a lot of arms, and the next time one of our boats goes through the Straits of Hormuz, start a shoot-up. Might cost some lives, and it was rejected because you can't have Americans killing Americans. But that's the level of stuff we were talking about, provocation. But that was rejected.
Seymour Hersh discussed the report during a recent interview at the Campus Progress Journalism Conference. Aid agencies in Afghanistan say violence has reached its worst level since 2001, with more than 260 civilians killed in July alone. The aid agencies say they may become unable to operate in parts of Afghanistan because of the increasing violence. The groups criticize the rising number of civilian deaths caused by both the Taliban and U.S.-led NATO airstrikes. The aid group said the number of U.S. and NATO airstrikes have increased by about 40% since last year. 19 aid workers have been killed so far this year, more than during all of 2007. Meanwhile, U.S. intelligence agencies are accusing Pakistan's powerful spy service of helping plan last month's deadly bombing at the Indian embassy in Afghanistan, which killed 54. The conclusion is based partly on intercepted communications between officers from Pakistan's Inter-Service Intelligence, or ISI, and the militants who carried out the attack in Kabul. On Thursday, President Bush discussed the improving security situation in Iraq, but never mentioned the war in Afghanistan. Bush said the increased stability in Iraq would allow the withdrawal of more American forces.
We now brought home all five of the combat brigades and the three Marine units that were sent to Iraq as part of the surge. The last of these surge brigades returned home this month. And later this year, General Petraeus will present me his recommendations on future troop levels, including further reductions in our combat forces as conditions permit.
In other Iraq news, the U.S. military has detained an Iraqi photographer who worked for the Reuters news agency, as well as BBC and National Public Radio. Ali El-Mashadani was detained in the Green Zone on Saturday while he was applying for a U.S. military press card. Reuters is urging the U.S. military to immediately release him or to publicly pronounce evidence to justify his detention. In business news, ExxonMobil has broken its own profit record by making $11.7 billion during the second quarter, the most profitable quarter for any business in history. This means ExxonMobil made about $90,000 per minute. Despite the record, ExxonMobil's profit fell short of Wall Street estimates and the company's stock fell about 2%. Meanwhile, analysts say ExxonMobil spent just 1% of its $41 billion in profits last year on alternative energy sources. In campaign news, Senator John McCain's campaign has accused Senator Barack Obama of playing, quote, the race card after comments Obama made at a campaign rally. McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, said, quote, Barack Obama has played the race card, and he played it from the bottom of the deck. It's divisive, negative, shameful, and wrong. Davis was referring to comments that Obama made on Wednesday when he suggested Republicans were trying to scare voters away from him. Obama said, quote, "So nobody really thinks that Bush or McCain have a real answer for the challenges we face. So what they're trying to do is make you scared of me. You know, he's not patriotic enough. He's got a funny name. You know, he doesn't look like all those other presidents on the dollar bills. You know, he's risky." That's essentially the argument they're making. Former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic appeared for the first time before a UN war crimes judge in The Hague on Thursday. Judge Alfonso Ri laid out the charges.
Mr. Karadzic, you are charged with one count of genocide under Article 4 of the Statute of the International Tribunal, with one count of complicity in genocide under Article 4 of the Statute, with five counts of crimes against humanity under Article 5 of the Statute, and with four counts of war crimes under Articles 2 and 3 of the Statute.
Karadzic said he would enter a plea after studying the charges.
I have to say this is a question of life and death. If Mr. Holbrook still wants my death and regrets there is no capital punishment, I am wondering if his arm is long enough to reach me, even here.
Thousands of politicians, aid workers, and activists are gathering in Mexico for an international conference on AIDS. The UN reported this week that the number of AIDS deaths fell for the second straight year. An estimated 2 million people succumbed to the disease in 2007. On Thursday, the executive director of UNAIDS, Dr. Peter Pio, said that the global food crisis was affecting the fight against AIDS.
Food crisis, which is true in many countries, and the poorer you are, the more affected you are by that, is affecting also the fight against AIDS. And we have the paradoxical situation that some people have access to pretty expensive and sophisticated drugs, but have no food to eat, nothing to eat. Or don't have the money to take the bus to go to the center and have no job.
The Washington Post reports federal border agents are now allowed to take and search a traveler's laptop computer, cell phone, or other electronic device without any suspicion of wrongdoing. Under the Department of Homeland Security policy, officials may also share copies of the device's contents with other agencies. The policy applies to anyone entering the country, including U.S. citizens. Senator Russ Feingold described the border policy as truly alarming. The policy covers any device capable of storing information in digital or analog form, as well as all papers and other written documentation. A federal judge has ordered former White House counsel Harriet Myers to testify before the House Judiciary Committee. The judge rejected the Bush administration's broad claims of executive privilege in its fight with Congress. And finally, NASA scientists have announced they have definitive proof that water exists on Mars after further tests on ice found on the planet in June by the Phoenix Mars lander. The Phoenix lander touched down in May on an ice sheet, and samples of the ice were seen melting away in photographs taken by the lander's instruments in June. Peter Smith is the principal scientist on the Phoenix Mars Lander project.
Through this analysis, we also hope to be able to answer a question that goes beyond just finding water ice, but is this a habitable zone on Mars? A habitable zone meaning that we have periodic liquid water, not today, but over time, and we have the materials that are the basic ingredients for life forms. It'll be for a future mission to find if anybody's home in this environment.
Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Anjali Kamath with Sharif Abdul-Quddus.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin with Israel and the occupied territories. Israeli troops fatally shot two Palestinian youths aged 10 and 17 this week in a village known for its nonviolent resistance. 17-year-old Yusuf Emira has been pronounced clinically dead after Israeli troops shot him on Wednesday. Emira was among several youths who were fired upon after attending the funeral of a 10-year-old Palestinian boy killed by Israeli soldiers a day earlier. The boy, Ahmed Musa, died instantly after being shot in the forehead. The shootings took place in the village of Na'alan, where residents have staged daily nonviolent actions against Israel's wall through the West Bank. The village was recently the site of another controversial shooting. On July 7th, an Israeli soldier was captured on film shooting a rubber bullet at a handcuffed Palestinian man. Hindi Meslech is a resident of Nalin and an organizer with the Nalin Popular Committee Against the Apartheid Wall. He was there when 17-year-old Yusuf Amira was shot and visited him yesterday in the hospital. Hindi Meslech joins us now on the line from Nalin. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for joining us. You witnessed the shooting of Yusuf Amira. Can you describe what happened?
Actually, yes, I was in the place when Yusuf got shot. Actually, it wasn't a protest or a demonstration after Ahmed was Ahmed's funeral. The village went as a protest to condemn Ahmed's killing. Yusuf was shot by two rubber-coated steel bullets in his head. One has destroyed totally his head. Ahmed Yusuf now is in branded, and we're expecting him any second to die.
Can you talk about what happened to the 9-year-old boy the previous day? It was after his funeral that Ahmed Yusuf Amira was shot.
Yeah, Ahmed is the 9-year-old that was killed. His funeral even was attacked by tear gas and rubber bullets. And after his funeral, Yusuf was dead the same day. Was shot, and now he's in hospital in Brandon.
And villagers are taking daily protests now against the building of the wall in the village. Can you describe what the demonstrations are like and the response of the soldiers?
Actually, I'm right now stuck in a house because the Israeli army has invaded the village. Because we had the Friday prayer at the land. The Israeli army, more than 100 soldiers now are invading the village, shooting tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at houses. The demonstration, as usual, they're non-violent and peaceful from the Palestinian side, but they're always met by a heavy use of violence from the Israeli army, rubber-coated steel bullets, gas bombs, and sometimes, as Ahmed case, live ammunition.
Can you describe where Nalin is in the West Bank and how the apartheid wall affects Nalin and the residents of Nalin?
Nalin is a village that is located in the west of Ramallah, in the West Bank, 25 kilometers in the west of Ramallah. The wall is going to confiscate more than 3,000 of the land from the village. Historically, Nalin land before 1948 used to own 58,000 dunams. During the war of 1948 and 1967, the village lost 40,000 dunams. The settlement and bypass roads has confiscated more than 8,000 dunams. So now there is 10,000 dunams left for the village. The wall is confiscating more than 3,000 dunams. In addition to the tunnel that will, this tunnel, the villagers will access and leave and go in the village from this tunnel that will be controlled by the Israeli army. So 6,700 left for the village out of from 58,000 dunams when they used to own it in 1948.
And Hindi, when did protests against the wall start? When did residents in Nalin start protesting the wall? Is this a recent thing? Has it been going on for a few years now? In 2004, the International Court of Justice ruled that the wall was illegal. The fourth anniversary was just earlier this month.
The wall started in Nalin in 2004, and then we had a court case. The court case recently and in April decided that the Israeli army has the right to build the wall. Then the Israeli army started building again the wall in May 2008 till now. Unfortunately, yes, the international court decided that the wall is illegal and should be dismantled. But Israel kept going on in building the wall, building the settlement, tunnel, bypass roads, confiscating and stealing more land from Palestinians.
And what is the mood right now on the ground? I mean, two youths have been killed in the past few days, one a 17-year-old, one 10 years old. Describe the scene for us right now on the ground.
The village has decided, like, determined to keep resisting because there is no other way. This is the only choice that's left for Palestinians to resist and struggle in a peaceful and nonviolent way. Unfortunately, the Israeli army, like the reply and reaction of the Israeli army is way violent. And as you heard, one is 9 years old has been killed. 17 years old has been shot. Now he's in the hospital. He will pass away in every second. Hundreds of villagers have been shot by rubber-coated steel bullets. Three of them have been shot by live ammunition, and they still remain in the hospital getting treatment for more than 3 weeks. Houses have been invaded and shot by tear gas and break and destroyed.
We're talking to Hindi Mesle, organizer with the Na'lan Popular Committee Against the Apartheid Wall. Hindi, I wanted to ask you, what has been the response of the Israeli army?
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
What has been the response of the Israeli army to the killing of the 9-year-old youth and the almost fatal shooting of the 17-year-old? He's now in a coma and pronounced clinically dead.
I don't know the reply of the army. There is no reply. I don't know what excuse they will come up. There is no excuse. Whatever the child was doing, throwing stones or whatever, there is no excuse and there is no right to kill a 9-year-old child or 17-year-old child when they are brought in a protest. The question is, why these children, they are in the protest? Because they're aware of what's happening and what's going on in their village. They're protesting against stealing their land, killing their brothers, shooting at their houses, invading their village.
And finally, Hindi Maslah, we're broadcasting on almost 700 stations around the United States and some around the world as well. What do you think is most important for people to know right now? What would you like people to understand about what's going on right now?
I will say it in a very simple way, as Jimmy Carter said. What's going on now in Na'lin is ethnic cleansing. Palestine is the Israeli army now is using the worst violence that has happened in the past, and it's so shameful that we are in the 21st century and Palestine is still occupied. It's the time that the international community and the world should say to Israel, stop. It's the time that Israel should stop its occupation.
Well, Hindi Maslah, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Hindi Maslah is an organizer with the Na'lan Popular Committee Against the Apartheid Wall, joining us from a demonstration on the ground there. Thank you for being with us and stay safe. When we come back, New York City lawyers are trying to force the group Eyewitness Video to turn over hundreds of videotape recordings of the protests during the 2004 RNC. Stay with us.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Anjali Kamat with Sharif Abdelkuddus.
New York City prosecutors have subpoenaed the group Eyewitness Video for hundreds of tapes shot during the 2004 Republican National Convention. The city claims it lost the tapes and needs them to defend itself against charges of wrongfully arresting hundreds of protesters. Critics say the city might be seeking evidence to avoid further embarrassment. Some of the tapes have already been used to exonerate a protester falsely accused of assaulting police officers. And just this week, a New York police officer was dismissed after he was videotaped body-checking a cyclist during last week's critical mass ride. The video has now been viewed more than 1 million times on YouTube. Eileen Clancy is the founder of Eyewitness Video. She joins us here in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Great to be here.
Eileen, can you start by talking about this latest subpoena from city officials? What is it and where does it stand right now?
There's actually two subpoenas, and I'm just going to give a small correction. It's not from prosecutors, because it's not a criminal case. It's in response to civil lawsuits. So we've been subpoenaed by the lawyers for New York City, the Corporation Counsel. And they are seeking essentially all the videotapes that we have archived relating to any protests that occurred during the Republican convention.
Well, step back a second. So what is Eyewitness Video? Describe what the group does and where you get all this archival footage from of the protests.
We were formed in the year 2000 after basically individuals started to see police attacks at demonstrations, a lot of arrests seemingly without cause. And we knew that there were a lot of video cameras out on the streets. But it seemed that the video never got to the lawyers. So even though people were arrested, we saw violence, and everyone knew that it was being recorded, all those cameras didn't really have an impact. So a couple of people had a similar idea at the same time, and I was one of actually probably over a dozen people who helped to found Eyewitness in 2000. The first action that we did, that we covered, was in the Republican convention in Philadelphia in the year 2000. And our tapes were used to help defend people there. And what we found was actually the most important thing, in case anybody wants to do any of this, is to have the clock on your camera set at the right time. Because if there's a police misstatement or there's a confusion about when something happened, that's very potent. And one thing that happened during that convention was a man who was arrested on the streets of Philadelphia and held on $500,000 bail, Terrence McGuckin. A police officer said that he was doing something in a certain period of time in a certain part of town. And we had a tape that showed he was across town, and it couldn't have occurred that way. And even though he had this $500,000 bail, and even though he had terrible charges against him, the judge basically immediately said, "What are we doing here?" and dismissed the case. And then we were onto something. So we continued to do that at demonstrations over the years until our biggest challenge, the Republican convention in New York City in 2004.
And these cases, this was 4 years ago, the Republican convention in New York. There's still cases now being settled in court right now as a result of Eyewitness Video?
Yeah, well, what happened was we documented the convention protests in partnership with the National Lawyers Guild, and then we worked with them to help defend people who'd been arrested at the demonstrations. There were 1,800 people arrested. And the New York Times figured out that there were about 400 individuals whose cases were either dismissed or acquitted solely based on the video. And the reason for that is it contradicted police officer statements in such an extreme way that basically the cases were thrown out or they were considered not believable. And what we learned was it turned out much more than we would have imagined. The police were lying in their sworn affidavits about the charges.
And why is the city claiming it needs the tapes now?
Well, what's happened is they were sued by hundreds of people, and there's also a class action that people are trying to, the lawyers are trying to get certified, that which would include 1,800 people, I guess, who were arrested. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to get every detail correct here. And so they're saying that they need the tapes because the tapes will help them prove that they had a good reason to arrest people. They're defending themselves against claims of false arrest. And so they came to us 3.5 years after the convention, which was surprising because essentially we had been all over the pages of the New York Times talking about this, so we figured they knew who we were and that we had videotapes related to this. So what they're saying is they want our tapes, and we've told them that the tapes, they already have something like 370 videotapes. So why are they coming to us? We're not suing anybody. If you're suing the city, then you have to give them anything related to that. But if you're not a party to the lawsuit, you know, they have to show that they really need it.
And so where does that stand right now? Do you have to hand over the tapes or not?
We filed a motion to quash. And that means that we're trying to basically get rid of, there's actually two subpoenas. We're trying to get rid of those subpoenas and say that, you know, that the city is not entitled to this material. And so the judge then will have to make a decision. And the city, of course, is challenging that, as they would.
Eileen Clancy, I have a question. Earlier this week, a critical mass biker was body checked by an officer in New York City. Can you talk about what happened? And the incident was also videotaped. Can you lay out what happened, what the police said, and then what the video showed?
Yeah, there was the usual critical mass bike ride every month in New York. There was a significant police presence at the gathering of the ride. I was at the gathering of the ride. I don't ride a bicycle, so I don't go along the ride. If I can't run along with it, I don't make it. So what happened was the bicycle ride went through Times Square, and at some point, one rider was basically tackled by a police officer. A bystander captured that moment on videotape. This was somebody who happened to be right nearby, who was a tourist, and just happened to capture it. And since there are a number of video activist groups that now have been monitoring this ride and monitoring the police conduct, and people were in a good position to basically try to make this videotape have an impact. The videotape was placed on YouTube, and because it's a particularly potent example. It's just from sort of the right angle. You can really see that this rider was going along and the police officer just runs over and slams him. And it just looks like a football maneuver. And it turned out, after this came out in the news media and investigators looked into it and reporters looked into it, that this police officer was a former high school football player and on Long Island and went to college on Long Island on a football scholarship. So something.
And initially the biker was arrested and charged, is that correct?
He was arrested and charged with assaulting the police officer, which is a very serious charge. So he had two misdemeanor charges, I think, in a lower charge. And the police officer made a statement that he'd been basically deliberately run into by the bicyclist. And I think you can see from the video that the bicyclist is veering away from the police officer who's pursuing this fellow.
And the officer claimed initially that the biker was veering in and out of traffic and aimed for him. Is that?
That's what the police affidavit says. So that's what was sworn to by the police officer under a penalty of perjury, which in this case would be a felony.
And in fact, there's no cars in the video.
It doesn't appear that there are. I mean, I wasn't there, and what you can see there is just right in front of you. There's police officers in the road, standing in the middle of the road for some reason. It's not clear why. And then the bicyclists are going past right there in Times Square. This videotape, I think, is the first tape that, you know, we've been associated with. We've helped to get some publicity around it. But it's the first tape of this kind that we've ever been even a little bit near that's really gone viral, which means that it's basically exploded across the internet, and it's been viewed 1 million times on YouTube. So that was pretty amazing. And it was covered by, you know, all the local television stations and the national news media, and there's just been tremendous interest in it. And the question has come up now, what's going to happen to the charges? This young man is still charged. The charges haven't been dropped yet. They may be dropped. And also, the police officer actually hasn't been dismissed from his job. He's been put on modified duties on suspension, so his badge has been taken away and his gun's been taken away and he's behind a desk. And so the police department has to decide, and the district attorney has to decide, what is to be done. If they determine that the police officer actually lied, you know, what is to be done with the situation here?
And in our first segment, I just want to go back. We were speaking to an activist in Palestine. They're protesting the wall over there. Two youths have just been shot, a 9-year-old and a 17-year-old. And a lot of what's happening has been instigated by this other incident where a Palestinian was held by Israeli forces. One of the officers was holding him by the arm while another pointed a rifle at his leg and shot him with a rubber bullet. This was captured on video. And it was part of that video was broadcast around the world, and it was part of this Israeli group called Shooting Back, which hands out cameras to Palestinians to capture exactly this kind of incidents. Can you talk about that? And, you know, it's related to eyewitness video, this kind of citizens journalism.
Yes, this group, B'Tselem, which has a project Shooting Back, has got a magnificent project. I was lucky enough to be on a panel with Orhan Yakubovic, who runs that project for B'Tselem. We were in a panel in Istanbul talking about basically watching police and the army and that sort of thing. And what they do is they hand out cameras to people who are living in these areas where there's so much trouble and that are militarized areas. And so what happens is if you have a news crew in there, you know, the army is a lot less likely to do some of the things that they're going to do when there's no news crew there. So they really have this brilliant project where they hand out many, many cameras. And then when this violence occurs or these problems occur or these controversial moments occurs, it's possible to create a record. In governments that use physical force and coercion will always also use control of information. And so using the digital technology, B'Tselem and Shooting Back is able to leverage information to show what really happened and actually put some power back in the hands of people who are the most oppressed.
Eileen Clancy, I have a question for you. Moving back to New York City, there's a piece in today's paper about the NYPD calling on citizens for amateur video evidence. And New Yorkers, the NYPD is asking for regular citizens to upload video or photo evidence of anything they see that might be suspicious onto their website. What's your response to this?
Well, I have to say, it really seems like a public relations move in relation to this police officer that was caught by an amateur videotape. And what they're asking is, we are going to have to investigate ourselves, and we would like you to give us all the evidence. And it'd be different if they were saying, why don't you give it into the Civilian Complaint Review Board? That's a watchdog agency. But unfortunately, NYPD has a dismal record of investigating themselves, I would say. And the Civilian Complaint Review Board actually lately put out a report really contending that even when, in the very small number of instances, they substantiate a complaint against a police officer, and they go to the police department for a trial and to get discipline, that they're disciplined in many fewer occasions than they used to be. So it's really not clear, you know, what the benefit of that is.
And so now we're just 3 weeks away from the Democratic Convention in Denver. Protests are planned for there. There's a massive security presence that's being planned, which we're also going to talk about later in the program. But what are your plans? What is Eyewitness Video's plans for 08?
Yeah, well, we're going to bring a crew to both presidential conventions. It's pretty exciting. And one of the reasons we're very interested in covering the conventions is really not sort of because we want sort of bad things to happen, but because what happens is the focus of the federal government, the law enforcement agencies and all that is very keenly directed at demonstrators. And when you cover these events completely, you're able to see the patterns. The patterns emerge, and that's what we used the Republican convention for in New York. We were able to find out that the police were using agents provocateurs. We were very surprised that the district attorney's office was faking video evidence, police video evidence. And we were able to show that the police officers lied in many instances. So we don't know what's going to happen in Denver and Minneapolis, St. Paul. But, you know, we're going to be there to cover it, and we'll be hoping that people share their videotapes with us. And if you'd like to help us, please send a contribution in through the website.
What do you mean faking video evidence?
Well, what happened in the 2004 demonstrations is in one instance, I discovered that there were two different copies of the same police videotape. And the district attorney had given a defense attorney a copy of a police tape for use at a trial and said, this is our evidence against you, this is our video evidence against you. And I found a copy of the police tape with a lot more video in it than was handed over as evidence. And it turned out that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office had removed two sections, and it would have to be deliberate. You can't do this by mistake. Mm-hmm. Two entire sections of several minutes. The sections that showed that the man who had these charges, Alexander Dunlop, was innocent of the charges and was extraordinary. And when that was discovered, the district attorney immediately dropped all the charges.
We're talking to Eileen Clancy, the founder of Eyewitness Video. And as we continue to look at surveillance and the conventions, we turn now to a news story out of Denver. Federal and state law enforcement officials in Colorado plan to increase intelligence operations during the Democratic National Convention in Denver and run a fusion center where intelligence analysts will collect and analyze reports of suspicious activity. The Colorado Independent reports the military will also be sharing intelligence information and providing support through U.S. Northern Command, a unit created in 2002 for Homeland Defense. Civil rights advocates fear the fusion center could enable unwarranted spying on protesters exercising their First Amendment rights at the convention. We're joined now by three guests. Erin Rosa is a reporter for the Colorado Independent and Online Daily. She broke the story on the role of Northern Command at the convention. She joins us from Denver. Mike German is the National Security Policy Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. He was an FBI agent specializing in domestic counterterrorism from 1988 to 2004. He joins us from Washington, D.C., and Eileen Clancy is still with us, the founder of Eyewitness Video. Erin Rosa, let's begin with you. You're the reporter for the Colorado Independent who first broke many of these stories that about the fusion centers that are being planned for Colorado for the upcoming DNC. Can you talk about what are the plans that the government's making and who exactly is going to be doing this surveillance?
Okay. Well, to start off with, what we would probably need to do is define what a fusion center actually is. And basically, they're centers meant to facilitate communications between federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies to share information about quote-unquote suspicious activities, which can include taking pictures or taking notes. The definition is very broad when it's defined by them. And essentially what the Colorado Independent has found out is that this fusion center, which is located in Colorado in the Denver metro area, they're going to be increasing intelligence operations during the convention. And they will be sharing information with the U.S. Secret Service, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Northern Command, which is actually stationed about approximately 70 miles from Denver.
And Erin Rosa, how is U.S. Northern Command involved?
Well, we have confirmed that U.S. Northern Command has been asked by the Secret Service to help out with convention security, which is bringing in a military entity into the convention security process. They will be providing materials such as security guards, security dogs to the U.S. Secret Service. They haven't elaborated on everything they're going to be assisting with. They will also be sharing information with the Fusion Center as they have done so in the past, intermittently, when it's warranted.
Turn to Mike German, National Security Policy Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. Mike German, you did a report, you co-authored a report in November 2007 about fusion centers, and you just put up an update to it earlier in the week. Can you talk about your concerns?
Sure. Our report in November was basically hoping to be a warning signal that we saw some problems with these centers, these fusion centers that were being created all over the country. And really what they are is a collaborative effort between not just state, local, and federal law enforcement, but also, as in Colorado, involving the military, private sector companies, and other non-law enforcement government agencies. So it really is breaking down all the arm's-length relationships and putting all these people together in an environment where it's unclear who is actually in charge and whose rules apply to the information that's being collected and shared and distributed through these fusion centers, and particularly where the military and private entities were involved. It seemed that it was inappropriate to incorporate them into what is essentially a law enforcement function. And in fact, there are some pretty long-standing laws that are supposed to prevent that sort of military intervention in law enforcement activities. So the November report was supposed to just, put up a warning to let people out in the communities around the country know about it, but also to let state legislators and members of Congress know that there are some problems with this lack of or ambiguity over who's in control, because we were afraid that would lead to problems. And, of course, the excessive secrecy that was surrounding these centers, it was hard to know exactly what they were doing and under whose authority they were operating. in the 6 months since, there have been so many news stories that have come out showing abuses that center around or are associated with these centers that we thought we better update the report to let people know that this isn't just a hypothetical concern, that there are actually misconduct going on now that needs to be addressed.
Chairman, I wanted to ask you to lay out how the fusion centers are a development from previous intelligence gathering mechanisms since 9/11. You had the TIPS program, you had the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Where do fusion centers fit in?
Well, it's interesting. Fusion centers sort of started organically around the country. It seemed like state and local law enforcement were frustrated with the Joint Terrorism Task Force's ability to break down the classification rules and actually share information with them. So they started creating their own networks to share state police information. And once the federal government saw those and saw them working, they started pouring in resources and sort of changing the nature of them to really encourage them to state and local law enforcement authorities and these other entities in the fusion centers to become intelligence collectors for the intelligence community, the federal intelligence community. And as you said, those earlier programs, TIPS and Matrix and those kind of programs, were centralized within the federal government. So it was easy for the civil liberties community and the privacy community to focus their efforts and get those things stopped. This is much more difficult because the federal government is saying, no, these aren't federal entities, they're state entities. So, you know, instead of one focal point, there have to be 50. And each one is actually different because they did grow up organically. And not all of them are engaged in the same sorts of behavior. So it's very difficult to generalize about what's going on. So it's really incumbent upon, you know, every local community to start asking questions of their local police departments and their local government officials to find out exactly what's happening in their neighborhood. And, you know, as your earlier stories today showed, where people think that nobody's watching, they'll do some really, you know, terrible things that aren't justified under any legal system. And in these centers, it appears that nobody's watching. And there's one story that we highlight in our report that happened in Los Angeles, where after 9/11, the very first fusion center, Los Angeles County Terrorism Early Warning Center, the co-founder of that center contacted the U.S. Northern Command after 9/11 and started a conspiracy to steal military intelligence records that later involved at least seven law enforcement officers and military reservists in this theft scheme, stealing military surveillance records apparently pertaining to Southern California mosques. And, you know, it's unclear why the military has those records in the first place, but the fact that this group could operate for 5 years stealing these highly classified records sort of is the, you know, the perfect storm of the issues that we brought up in our earlier report, that this is a real problem that needs to be addressed, because it wasn't any internal controls that discovered this theft ring. It was actually discovered by accident when the Marine Corps down at Camp Pendleton was searching for stolen Iraq war booty and searched a storage locker here in Manassas, Virginia, and found not just the stolen Iraq war trophies, but also boxes of highly classified records. And that's how this ring was stopped after 5 years.
Well, we have to break. We'll continue this discussion when we come back. Mike German is the National Security Policy Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. We're also speaking with Aaron Rosa, the reporter for the Colorado Independent, and Eileen Clancy, the founder of Eyewitness Video. Stay with us. is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Sherif Abdelkoudous with Anjali Kamat. We're talking about fusion centers and intelligence gathering at the upcoming DNC and RNC. We're talking with Mike German, the National Security Policy Council for the American Civil Liberties Union, Aileen Clancy, the founder of Eyewitness Video, and Aaron Rosa, a reporter for the Colorado Independent. Aaron, you have this amazing story just recently in the publication talking about how the Colorado Army National Guard is renting out hundreds of rooms in Denver for the convention. Can you talk about that?
Well, it would appear from records from a federal database that the Colorado Army National Guard is apparently constructing a makeshift barracks in the far east region of the city that will be on call. They're not saying what the purpose is for nearly 400 people to be stationed in this private university. They're actually going to be stationed at Johnson & Wales University in the eastern region of the city. More than 400 troops in that one area. They've rented more than 500 rooms across the city, and they're not saying what the purpose will be for, but they have confirmed that it will be all Colorado National Guard personnel.
Eileen Clancy, I want to turn to you. Can you talk a little bit about the RNC and the documents you've obtained from the 2004 RNC?
Yeah, there's a document that has been made public before that was compiled by the Secret Service in charge in the Republican Convention in New York City. And the Secret Service is the lead agency for these national special security events, like all the presidential conventions. And the document is a best practices and lessons learned document that was presented a couple of months after the 2004 convention closed. And it's a PowerPoint presentation, so we don't have a lot of details. It's all bullet points. But what it shows is it shows the structure of the committees that, looked after this kind of part of the convention business. And there's a subcommittee of the Law Enforcement and Public Safety Group that's on intelligence and counterterrorism. I'm going to just take a look at the page. And the objective of this subcommittee was to obtain, assess, and share information about individuals and groups who might pose a threat to protect these designated venues and or the RNC itself. But what's fascinating about it, besides we know that the FBI and the police department and the Secret Service were involved, the members of this committee include the CIA, the Department of Defense, DIA, which is the Defense Intelligence Agency, and it also includes something called TTIC, which is the Terrorist Threat, I think it's Integration Center, if I'm getting that right, or maybe it's information. And what happens for these national security special events like the conventions is that they make their own fusion center just for this event. It's like an ad hoc special project, kind of like what we're doing, but with a lot more money and a lot more power. And what it says here is that through this Intelligence Fusion Center and the Joint Terrorist Task Force Fusion Center, which is yet another fusion center that was put in place, this subcommittee achieved its primary objective of sharing threat, and then it says demonstration intelligence among the subcommittee members. So the point here is that the CIA, the Defense Department, and the upper reaches of the federal, what they call the intelligence community, believe it or not, they are having access to intelligence, what they call intelligence about demonstrations. I might just call it information, but they seem to need to share it. Now, I don't even know if it's legal for the CIA to be involved in domestically to this extent, but there's the Department of Defense. This document was presented by Stephen G. Hughes, who was the agent in charge of the 2004 convention, and happens to be the agent in charge of the Democratic Convention in Denver this year.
And the government using the public airwaves for surveillance tests, you have information on that as well.
Well, what we saw during the Republican convention in New York was that there was an experimental project, a pilot project, that took spectrum, digital spectrum that's owned by WNET Channel 13 in New York City, the PBS sort of flagship in New York City. And what they did was they routed a special test for two-way video so that, say, a police officer could have a camera where he could be videotaping something, and it would go, would be transmitted through the Empire State Building, the transmitter on top of the Empire State Building, and then to through a Department of Defense satellite to a server in Virginia that was a military server, and also that they could pass information sort of back and forth. And the thing about this was it's non-line of sight, so it was a special kind of technology where the buildings wouldn't get in the way. And that's an example of how the federal government and local governments use the conventions basically as an excuse to make a laboratory to play with these toys and set up surveillance processes that we're going to see sometime in the future. You saw this in New York City where they took the money to make it from the conventions, the federal budget for that was given to the city to make an emergency operations center, and they call it a situations room. And they put in all this video apparatus. Similarly, last year, a deputy chief in Denver testified to a House subcommittee about fusion centers and how they were going to use the convention in Denver as an opportunity to basically lay a structure for what they called a super fusion center. And so they're going to take some of that $50 million that Denver's going to get and apparently and going to be using it to build a more permanent and more powerful surveillance apparatus for Colorado.
I want to bring Mike German back into the discussion. Mike German, you were a former FBI special agent and terrorism analyst. Can you talk about what Eileen Clancy just talked about? What is the legality of the CIA and the military being involved in domestic operations?
Well, you know, as I said, it's very ambiguous. You know, this isn't just something that's happening in the future. It's happening in the future in Colorado, but it's actually going on now elsewhere. January, the Director of National Intelligence issued functional standards for suspicious activity reporting to get all the police departments and all the different agencies and elements involved in the fusion centers to report suspicious activity in a standardized format for the purpose uploading this information into the information sharing environment so the information could be shared easily among the various fusion centers, but also with the intelligence community. So basically what this system is doing is creating basically deputizing every state and local law enforcement officer to be an intelligence collector for the intelligence community. This information is being directly, you know, created in a way so it's accessible by these intelligence agencies. And, you know, part of the problem is that it's unclear what the rules are. And, you know, when you see something like the CIA participating on these panels and the military involved, it's unclear who's actually in charge. And that's really a large part of the problem that we're seeing as these things are moving forward, because the information is already being collected. Right after the DNI put out those standards, the Los Angeles Police Department issued an order compelling their officers to report criminal and non-criminal suspicious behavior that can be indicative of terrorism. And they listed 65 behaviors. And Aaron mentioned some of them. But one warning I'll put out there because of the early part of the story, one of the precursor behaviors to terrorism that's identified in the order is taking video. And we put in our report a couple of instances where people taking video were stopped by police officers simply for taking pictures or video. And in some cases, particularly where they're taking photographs or video of police, it actually resulted in arrests. So, you know, when you're out there with your video camera, a police officer reading this report may say that's a precursor to behavior to terrorism and you know, get involved in what you're doing.
And Aaron Rosa, you've written about how even if someone's reported the suspicious activity and it's dismissed afterwards, that activity is still recorded in a database and remains there.
Yes, and that's probably one of the most disturbing aspects about this is that officials with the Fusion Center here have confirmed that even if they receive a report of suspicious activity, if it merits investigation, they will forward it to the appropriate agency to investigate. The Fusion Center itself does not do investigations. However, even if even if activity does not merit an investigation, they make a log of that. And they hold that data for an indefinite period of time. They don't have any kind of sunset deadlines on destroying data after a period of time, even though the officials with the Fusion Center have also said that they don't really need the data after 2 months.
And I might add.
I might add to that
the Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, and Major City Chiefs Association issued a report following the LAPD order adopting that procedure and recommending it for every other city. And there's a schematic in that that shows how the suspicious activity report flows. There's a federal law that says a law enforcement intelligence database cannot contain personally identifiable information unless there's a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. But the schematic clearly shows that even before that decision is made of whether there's reasonable suspicion and the police department itself can keep the information, they will have already reported it to the Joint Terrorism Task Force and to the Fusion Center. And that's sort of this shell game where the information goes, and that it can be placed sort of in this database separate from the police database so they can remain compliant with the law, but they know that they have routine access to the information at the Fusion Center. So it's sort of like just putting it in a different drawer and pretending that it's not theirs anymore.
Mike German, we just have a minute left. If I can just ask you one question about your response to recent revelations that the Maryland State Police have been spying on activists against the death penalty and anti-war activists.
Absolutely, and that's a perfect example where the Maryland State Police, you know, sort of taking this encouragement from the federal government, expand beyond what normal police function is, beyond normal law enforcement function, and start becoming intelligence collectors against protest groups. And the reports that we obtained from them make clear that there was no indication of any sort of criminal activity, quite the opposite, that they were peaceful at all times. And yet that investigation went on for 14 months, and these reports were uploaded into a federal database. Now, the Department of Homeland Security and the Fusion Center are now claiming they never accessed that information, but it was sitting there in a database that was accessible to them at any time. So really, it's a semantic difference whether they actually did, because they could have. And you know, the problem is when all these agencies are authorized to go out and start collecting this information and putting it in areas where it's accessible by the intelligence community, it's a very dangerous proposition for our democracy.
We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you all for being with us. Eileen Clancy is the founder of Eyewitness Video, joining us here in New York. Aaron Rosa is a reporter for the Colorado Independent. And Mike German is a National Security Policy Counsel for the ACLU. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy of the show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Anjali Kamath with Sharif Abdul-Quddus. Amy Goodman will be back on Monday. It's been an honor to host the show. Thanks for joining us.